And yes, welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell joining you now on ABC RN across the nation for the next hour of your morning. And today we turn our attention to the saddest scenes of the week.
This morning, the horror of the refugee crisis that's gripping Europe took on a new face, that of a three-year-old boy.
Those that do make it to Europe start arriving from early in the morning. Just a few, then many. Hundreds become thousands, following the railway line that leads from Serbia to Hungary, and hopefully a new start in places like Germany. But they are being stopped at countries along the way.
A policeman tries to explain to an agitated crowd that if they come to Hungary, they have to be registered. But that is the one thing the tens of thousands of people passing through from Serbia don't want. Most have just one goal in mind.
The razor wire marks the border, 175 kilometres of it, designed to keep people out of Hungary. But there's a gap along the railway.
The image of a drowned boy, a three-year-old Syrian asylum seeker, is bringing home the European migrant crisis. His photograph, accompanied by the words, "humanity washed ashore," has become the top trending hashtag on Twitter and other social media sites today.
Today the government is making two important announcements about the humanitarian and security crisis in the Middle East. The first is that Australia will resettle an additional 12,000 refugees from the Syria-Iraq conflict.
Yes, I wonder what you've been feeling as you watch the asylum seeker crisis unfolding across Europe. That footage of families streaming out of war zones with nothing but each other and a plastic bag of possessions, if they're lucky. The bodies of children swept up on a Turkish beach. Crowds of people on foot, walking long highways in the hope of a safe haven at the end. As different countries open their arms and others shut their borders to people fleeing war and persecution and violence, have you found yourself asking, as I have at times, hasn't the world been here before? Is this history repeating itself? What do you think our duty of care as a global community in times like this is? And I'm wondering if this is personal for you. Is there an experience in your life that changes the way you feel about the plight of millions of individuals in the world seeking refuge at the moment? What's your story? 1300 22 55 76. We'd like to hear from you today, along with our guests. That's 1300 call RN, 1300 22 55 76. You might like to SMS us. That's 0418 226 576. Tweet us at RN Life Matters. And for WA, go to our listener line, 028 333 1430. That live line again, 1300 22 55 76. And there's our Facebook page as well. Are we, for example, seeing echoes of the treatment that Jewish people received as they fled the Holocaust of World War II? When prejudice or racism saw some nation states shut their doors to those in critical need, it was Jewish people then. It is Muslim and Christian people now, different populations, same plight, perhaps. What do you think? In fact, there are 60 million refugees and internally displaced people in the world right now, according to the UNHCR. That's the highest since World War II. A third of the world's refugees come from just two nations, Syria and Iraq. So I want to hear from you this morning. If you've got a family story that affects how you're feeling about what's happening in Europe, and indeed your thoughts about Australia's own response to the crisis, 1300 22 55 76. Call us now. We're joined this morning by three people who have given a lot of thought to this issue. And Di Lee is CEO and founder of Dawn. That's the Diverse Australasian Women's Network. She's a counsellor on Fairfield Council in New South Wales. one of the most diverse local government areas. Her family were refugees after the Vietnam War. She's made documentaries about the experience. Good morning, Di.
Good morning, Natasha. How are you?
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
We've got Akram Azimi too with us. He's joining us in Perth. He's a sociologist studying attitudes towards refugees. He has his own story. His family fled the Taliban. And in 2013... he was named Young Australian of the Year. Good morning, Akram.
Good morning, Natasha.
Thanks for joining us. Klaus Neumann is with us too. He's Professor of History at Swinburne University in Melbourne. He's the author of Across the Seas, Australia's Response to Refugees, a History, and he specialises in Holocaust memories, in refugee and immigration policies in Australia, also global responses to refugees. Good morning to you, Klaus.
Good morning, Natasha, and good morning, Di and Akram.
Good morning.
Excellent, excellent. Look, I'll ask you all, and I'll start with you, Klaus. What have you been feeling as you see the scenes of refugees fleeing across Europe?
What I've been feeling is distress at the response of countries, but also distress at the level of public debate, particularly in Australia. I think we have focused perhaps a little bit too much on how we feel about this rather than on what the refugees who are currently fleeing places such as Syria and Iraq are experiencing.
Mm. Akram, you were 12 when your family fled the Taliban regime in 1999. You, your mother and your brother, I gather, made it to Australia. Does that affect how you're feeling, responding to the scenes in Europe?
Yeah, I suppose there's no choice. We cannot interpret anything outside the lens of our previous experiences. And having this particular experience of having to walk from one country to another, of having to run from one place to another, there's so many memories that it brings up. And sometimes I have to actually turn it off because it does bring back so many painful memories of that time. What has been interesting, putting on my sociologist hat over the last couple of weeks, is that I have noticed a slight shift, and that shift has been in regards to the idea that these are human beings that we need to protect, as opposed to we need to be protected from. We've learned a little bit more about why they might do what they do and the level of danger they find themselves in. And this has changed the discourse just a little bit, but it has been enough to change it in a way that I haven't seen over the last 15 years in Australia.
A distinct shift, perhaps. Be interesting to hear from callers on that. Di Lee, you too came to Australia, well, from a refugee camp in Hong Kong in the late 70s with your family. So how does that shape how you're seeing things?
Look, I have been struggling a lot looking at that image of that young boy, Island Kurdie, on the Turkish beach. And I tell you, it's kind of it tugged my heart because it also reminded me of that image of that young girl during the Vietnam War. And the napalm bomb. And
running naked down the street.
And the images of people crossing, refugees, men and women, the innocent people that are the victims of these wars, fleeing. And I remember as a child of seven, fleeing with my mother and two younger sisters. That scene, that crowded scene, is just so. I can put myself in that crowd, and I think for what we feel, it's about what ought want to do as a nation, as human beings. What ought want to do in this crisis, in particular, if we actually Australia take part in going in sending in troops into countries. And fighting a war there, however just it may be, what do we do with the outflow or the consequences of people fleeing? And we have to play a role. And seeing that image and getting people to act because of a child's body on the beach, it took that to turn the crowd around, the population around. Did we have to get to that point for people to shift?
Well, yes, and I'm interested, Klaus, in your view on that too, because this is not the first time that we've had a defining photo. In this case, the photo of Eileen Kurdi. Di mentioned the girls running down the road under a napalm attack. But tens of thousands of children have been dying in Syria and Iraq over many years now, and things haven't happened.
Yeah, and I listened to Tim Costello, was it yesterday or the day before, when he said his organisation has been trying to raise money for Syria and they haven't been able to get even $1 million in donations from Australians over the whole time since the war in Syria started.
Why not, do you think?
Because that image was lacking. So it is really the image of the boy on the beach that suddenly turned things around. Now, the unfortunate things about these images is that they elicit emotions, they trigger our feelings, but these feelings can be very fleeting. Mm. They can be very fickle. So in a month or 2 months' time, not many of us will remember that image.
Yes, that comes to mind for me too, Akram Azimi, that little boy's image may just disappear from our consciousness and lose the impact.
There is a danger of that, but when it comes to children, and particularly their innocence, it lends itself to a structural shift in a way that perhaps doesn't really work for adults. Firstly, part of this is the limitation of our brains, and we can only empathize qualitatively, not quantitatively. We can't quantitate with the hundreds of thousands, yet it is this one image that evokes something so powerful within us. For me, there's actually an interesting parallel with an experience I had when I was much, much younger, when we had the so-called Children Overboard scandal. And I remember there were images of children around that time. And this was before the Senate report that came into it later. And I remember adults would ask me that, you know, do Afghan people not really care about their children? Is it something that they don't really care about? Because they saw those images of those children at sea. And the idea that we were the type of people who would throw our children into sea to blackmail Australia into accepting us. That, even though later that turned out not to be the case, what I found really interesting is even now, folks still believe that people actually threw their children into sea. So when it comes to children, it has this ability to stick because it is so powerful.
Yes.
What I would be interested in is how do these feelings get channeled? What kind of action does this produce? Because those actions have the possibility of creating something that wasn't there before. What do we do with these feelings? And while these feelings are so strong, and a lot of leadership goes into that.
Let me take some calls. I know you want to pick up on that, Klaus, but I'll just take a few calls. Louise in Canberra, good morning to you. Welcome to Life Matters. You teach international students.
Yes, I do, and I've previously taught high school children who came as refugees, mainly from Africa.
And?
Oh, sorry. And you know, the thing that I would mostly want to say is that, particularly the students I know at the moment, because they're you know of an older age, they are people just like us. I have made many, many Muslim friends. They have values just like us. They have values of decency and love and compassion. They just want to bring up their children and live in peace and prosperity, as does anyone in the West. And the division of Christian and Muslim really, really upsets me greatly. I hear it even from my own family, and I see racist posts and videos on Facebook every day, where if someone who is coming from Syria seems to have done something a little bit wrong or a little bit angry, suddenly the finger's pointed, oh, see, this is what they're like. But actually, they are not like that. They are like us. They are us.
Louise, thank you so much. A really passionate response there. And this morning, we're getting a sense from you, and along with our guests, about how you're feeling in response to the crowds, the hordes, the millions of people fleeing war zones across Europe at the moment, how you feel about Australia's response. But most particularly, I'm interested in Your own personal engagement with this experience, is this personal for you? Do you have a refugee story in your family? Perhaps you are of Jewish heritage and the impact of the Holocaust has left a profound imprint on your family story and it affects how you look at the refugee crisis in Europe today. Give us a call, 1300 22 55 76. That's 1300. Call RN. I'll take some more calls and then come back to my guest. Stephen in Paddington, your dad was a refugee in 1938 from Austria.
That's right, yes. Yes, he was. Came via Britain and got to New Zealand and married my mother. Yeah, so that's his story. I wish I'd known more of my father's story than when he was alive. But anyway, look, these 12,000 people who are coming from Europe, who have Syrian refugees, they are no different from the people who are in the detention centres, camp of gulags across Australia and in Manus and in Nauru. They are no different. So either we lock up the 12,000 Syrian refugees as they arrive, or we free the people in Australia's detention gulag. That's a simple, and the people who, like Julie Bishop, who try and tell us different, that they are somehow of bad character, the people in the detention camps, are just misinforming the public. They did what they fled their country, they did what they had to do to get to a safe haven. Unfortunately, Australia turns out not to be a safe haven, but a place of high danger for refugees. But we come clean, we have to come clean and let these people out.
Stephen, thank you very much for sharing your view there. Thank you.
Okay.
A text message along the same lines. It took the image of a dead little innocent to finally force our government to take some moral responsibility for a disaster we helped to create, but we are not allowed to see images of women and children who are being sexually assaulted and molested in the Manus and Nauru concentration camps. When will we, the people, do something about this and release these refugees into Australia? SMS us on 0418 226 576. You might have a different view, and we'd like to hear all views today. Judy in Bendigo, good morning. Your dad was a German Jewish man.
Yes, hello. That is the case. And my father managed to escape the Gestapo, literally as they came in through the front door, he went out the back. But he could only find sanctuary in Africa because, of course, at that time, countries had quotas now, and they would not allow Jews in or refugees in. My father's brother was not so fortunate. He managed to escape to Holland, but could go no further because of the quotas, and ended up, as you know, Holland was invaded by the Nazis. And he was hidden, he was betrayed, and he eventually died in a concentration camp. Mm. And I want to say, as Stephen said, there should be no quotas, there should be no barriers. We should open our arms and say, welcome, you need help, we will give it.
Judy, thank you very much for sharing your story and that view. Klaus Neumann, is this current crisis a case of history repeating itself, with the world flapping its arms and working out how to react, some nations being openly resistant or prejudiced about those seeking asylum, fearful for their own populations as well? Is this history repeating itself?
Well, we certainly have been there before. And when the UN High Commissioner for Refugees recently said this is a completely unprecedented situation, he was wrong. So the number of refugees that you just mentioned, 59.5 million at the end of last year, that is not the highest number of refugees that the world experienced in the past 100 years. So there were more refugees at the very end of the Second World War. There were possibly more displaced people in China during the China-Japan War than there are now globally. So we certainly have been there before. I think we've also been there before in the sense that we have, on previous occasions, reacted emotionally to images and to individual stories. And I just want to pick up on something that both Stephen mentioned and that Akram was saying. So let's go back to 2001. The image that comes to mind of a single child that triggered our emotions was that of Shayan Badrai, who was an Iranian boy locked up in Villawood at the time, who wasn't eating and then had to be taken to the Westmead Children's Hospital in Sydney every now and again, being brought back to Villawood. Now, that was something that was broadcast on Four Corners with a camera that was smuggled into Villawood, created a lot of responses, and they were then very quickly forgotten when the Children Overboard affair happened. So not many people now will remember the story of Cheyenne. And I'm just afraid that something similar is going to happen again. So I think we have to ask ourselves, why is it in Australia that we are so easily moved by images, we are so easily moved by stories, but we aren't able to sustain our engagement?
Yes, Dai Lee, I wonder how you feel about that. I mean, you're a businesswoman, you're a member of the New South Wales Liberal Party, you're a local councillor. You've had such an interesting, had to represent interesting tensions in yourself publicly, haven't you? Because there's the politics of how we talk about this, and then there's the personal connection that you have.
Yeah, look, can I just go to, have we been there before? Yes, we have.
Yeah.
In various situations, as Klaus and Akram has mentioned, as well as the, you know, my situation. There is, I think, in terms, if you talk about politics, obviously the political arena, whichever major parties would use a situation like this to their best political, you know, electoral benefit. So it's not one party or another. In terms of, if I can respond in terms of the political, in terms of to respond to Steve as well, how if we were to, you know, take in 12,000 Syrian refugees now, then why shouldn't we actually open up the detention centres? Now, having been in detention centres myself, in refugee camps in Southeast Asia, in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
I understand the need for a country to actually process the intake of, at times, in Hong Kong during the Vietnamese exodus, hundreds and thousands of Vietnamese fleeing communism. So they had to do something to make sure that people are processed. And as you know, back in those days, and Klaus, correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a processing system in place, and the international community got together under UNHCR, led by, I believe, Malcolm Fraser in Australia, to make sure that we have proper way to make, you know, place five countries in Southeast Asia to process them. And then second port of asylum, the Western nations are then able to then resettle them, which happened with my family. We got resettled in Australia because we chose to come to Australia. The majority of people, actually, refugees, for some reason want to go to the land of America, not Australia.
Yeah. I don't understand it myself. So, the land of the free, perhaps.
The land of the free, that's right. So I think, I mean, I suppose in recent times, more and more people have discovered Australia. Now, we need to, so those who have arrived here on our shores by boat, they are being processed. Now, I suppose we need to look at what's happening in Syria is such a humanitarian crisis that the government had to address that issue, just as John Howard did in 1999 with the Bosnian War. So I think for me, I think there are a lot of people like myself in the political arena are human beings at the end of the day, and we also look at, you know, when we see images like that, we want to do something. And then politics is politics.
Yes, but you see, but it's so interesting, isn't it? Because politics does shape the opinions and responses of a populace.
I agree, yes. And going back to what we say in terms of what can we do, I think it comes down to our society, how our leaders lead the nation. What messages are they sending to the population of 24 million in Australia, and whether or not Australia can actually embrace and open their arms? And you know what? I find Australians are very generous. Initially, we have this
If they're allowed to be.
Yeah, if they're led to be. if they're led to be generous and open and embracing. So
okay. Okay, let me come to Akram Azimi. Joining us this morning, I should say, on Life Matters is Di Lee. She is founder and CEO of DAWN, Diverse Australasian Women's Network. She's a councillor on the Fairfield Council in New South Wales. She was a Vietnamese refugee to Australia in the 70s. Akram Azimi is with us. He's a sociologist studying attitudes towards refugees. He too was a refugee from Afghanistan who came here in around 1999 with his mum and brothers. And Klaus Neumann is with us too, Professor of History at Swinburne University. Because the politics does shape how countries respond, Klaus. And I'll get a comment from you too, Akram, because, you know, we're seeing now with these hundreds of thousands of people across Europe, the language is striking. Some people say migrants, some people say refugees, some people say asylum seekers. That's a politicisation too, isn't it? Yes, it's a category of, and a definitional category, but it does shape how a populace feels about people.
Yes, and I think politicians in Western Europe are very careful now with the language that they are using in order not to incite xenophobia and racism. So I fully agree with what Dali just said. We need to be led to be generous. When we look back over the past 70-odd years, the Australian response to refugees who come unannounced has always been very negative. And that sometimes has then translated also into an unsympathetic response to refugees generally. Mm. So there's very little that has changed in that respect. But what has changed in more recent times is that the politicians have amplified that kind of response. So I think we need to expect from our political leaders to be more mature.
So you're from Germany, and that's an interesting case in point right now. Last week, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she expects to see 800,000 asylum applications this year, I think. The number could be revised up to 1 million. She's put in an extra 6 billion euros on helping people resettle. Do you think part of the reason as to why Germany is taking a lead this time has to do with the history of World War II and the Holocaust? Is there a connection to be made there?
Well, I think it has to do with the history of the Holocaust. It has to do with very recent events. It has to do with the crisis in Greece. You know, Germany got a fairly bad reputation in the last few months by being so incredibly stern with the Greeks. So there's a reason for Germany as a country to make up. But I think the response of ordinary Germans can't just be explained by that. What I find really striking is the difference between how Germans respond to refugees now and how they did respond in the early 1990s, when there were also hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers streaming into Germany from the former Yugoslavia.
Indeed, and there was resistance.
Yes, and the
big
kind of
resistance.
Xenophobia and racism that was on show there was really, really awful.
So what's changed?
The country is now led by a woman. Sorry, I just have to put that in.
But interesting look, perspective.
Yes, it is an interesting perspective, I think. I think, it's definitely got to do with gender leadership in that sense as well, because that's just one factor. I'm not saying that's the factor. I think leadership, I think that in a lot of our leaders in today's society, they tend to be more macho, tend to be more about, if I can use the word, warmongering.
Well, they don't allow themselves necessarily to be compassionate.
Exactly.
They don't allow themselves, I mean, and maybe that's to do a bit with the media cycle.
It is.
They don't want to expose their own vulnerability, and that's what it takes sometimes to express compassion publicly.
Yes, and when you were mentioning before about politics, this is shaping our conversation, I think it's also media, and I'm lumping media in one kind of category here, but mainstream media, it's how you actually sell that story. And of course, there are different layers, because it's not just sharing an actually authentic and genuine story, because they have to pitch, you know, the sales part and ratings and all of that stuff. So it's very complicated. How can you actually tell a story that is actually genuine and that actually can touch people's mind and heart? And, yeah.
Okay, I'll just come to some calls in a moment. I'll just get a quick response from you, Akram Azimi, because your work is around how people morally engage, morally understand the issue of asylum seekers. So what prompts that moral engagement of individuals?
Right. And this is, again, the key here is probably understanding the definition of the situation and who gets to define the situation. And that's going to engage our moral intuitions. Now, those who arrive by boat in Australia, they've undergone a really complex process whereby they've come to a particular place where they're understood in a very specific way by the majority of Australians. Now, a lot of times when we talk about how Australians think about those who arrive by boat, we often say, and I've heard this overseas, Australians are not very nice people. And I have to constantly defend them and say, no, that's not true. We're incredibly moral people. In fact, this decision itself to keep these people on these far-flung islands, it itself comes from a very moral place, a very strong moral intuition. And that is, those who come by boat are actually perceived as a level deeper than the normal criminal. You see, a normal criminal who breaks into our home, he knows he's breaking our laws. The worst kind of criminal is the one who comes into our home and doesn't even acknowledge our laws. He more or less takes over the house and completely negates our political will over our house. That is how those people are conceived.
Okay, let's take some calls. Full board, and I want to get to you. Susan in Tasmania, welcome to Life Matters. You'd like to, thinking of those millions living in refugee camps.
Yes, I'm probably going to take a slightly different tangent from
Please do.
What I think is quite overwhelmingly emotional, and I am myself deeply moved by the images of that young boy, equally deeply moved by the images of the young Palestinian boys who were playing soccer, who were blown apart in Gaza, in the bombing of Gaza. And look, I think we've got to look a little bit deeper than this immediate emotional response and say, yes, we want to give succor to lucky 12,000 people when there are so many millions in the Middle East, in the Syrian camps, who are living without decent support. And the $500 million that we are spending to relocate these fortunate few could be far more effectively used to support those millions that are still locked in refugee camps, mostly being women and children who cannot, or the poor, who cannot afford the effort to get out of there. Might I add that my ex-husband is Muslim and I have a child with him. I host people from all over the world for long periods, and I actually have signed up to host refugees in my home and on my farm. So it's not a personal objection at all, Muslims or refugees. But let's understand this, that in Syria they're going not just through a massive war, but through a drought caused by climate change. Their population has grown from 3.5 million in 1950 to 23 million today. These are the things which drive people, opportunity and famine and war and climate change. So let's try and look a little deeper than that first, very understandable emotional response.
Yes, very interesting and strong point you make. Susan, thanks for ringing. And I was interested to see, just at a more specific level, that the Vatican elected to welcome two families into the Vatican, which was a sort of surreal contrast to the scale of this issue. Maria in Sunshine Court, I think, is that right?
Sunshine Coast.
The Coast, yes. Beg your pardon, I just didn't quite get the abbreviation. Your mum and brother were evacuated out of Darwin in 1942. How is that shaping your impressions?
Well, we're just reminding everyone, we've had refugees in our own country, and after the Darwin was bombed, a lot more refugees poured out of Darwin, of course. But it's not to make light of what's happening in Europe. That's hell on earth. But just reminding people of people who sleep rough in the long grass in Catherine, those folk are perhaps refugees from some awful horror. And if we had a photograph of children sleeping rough in Catherine in the grass, maybe that would evoke passion in our Prime Minister to do something about homelessness in Australia. Maybe, you know, we've got localised refugees from all sorts of abuse or escaping from economic misfortune. So, yeah, it's not to make light of what's going on in Europe, but compassion for refugees in our own country currently.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you, Maria, for making that point. And I'll come back to Klaus on that in just a moment, because that tension between the international and the domestic gets played out in all sorts of interesting ways in relation to refugees. Wayne in Nimbin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you'd like to talk about Australia's role.
Yes, look, I think Australia, Europe and the United States have destabilised the whole area and created this situation. Invaded Iraq on a false premise, really over oil, because Saddam was going to do away with the dollar and trade oil. It's the only reason for that war. And now we've destabilised the whole region for fossil fuels, and this is a consequence of what we've done. So I think John Howard and his troops are actually war criminals and are responsible for what's happening over there.
Thanks for the call, Wayne.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ariel in New South Wales, good morning.
Hi. Well, I've got my comment is probably pretty naive and basic, but I think people are sort of vaguely divided into those who think this could happen to me, this could affect my family or something or somebody I love, and those who think this could never happen to me, this has nothing to do with me, and, you know, I just, in the end, we'll kind of blame the victim, because that's quite often how we get around us over sympathy, as it were, you know, because we think, oh, well, they must have put themselves in a bad situation. I would never do that. I think, you know, if we could sort of get out of that, I don't know what it is, solipsist thing, we could be a lot more compassionate, and we could be much more broad-minded. And we have got boundless planes to share and all of that. So thanks for your program.
And thank you for your call. Back to you, Klaus Neumann. A caller raised an interesting point about those in need within Australia who are kind of refugees in a sense in their own land here. And that's an interesting tension, isn't it? Because certainly in Europe, the economic crisis across Europe has exacerbated people's anxieties for their own situation and well-being, and perhaps their resistance to welcoming in those in need fleeing war zones.
Well, I think the first thing to remember is when we talk about refugees, that the first refugees in Australia were Indigenous people who fled when the country was taken over by white settlers. A lot of people are now saying there is not enough money to go around. If we take those 12,000 in, what's going to happen to people who are in need in Australia? Are they going to have reduced services? And often Indigenous people are quoted in that respect. Is there enough money for Aboriginal people for services in outback locations if we take in refugees? I think,
and for the 1 in 6 that are apparently children in Australia who are living under the poverty line, as we define it.
That's right. But I think we ought to keep things in perspective. So one of your callers said, you know, do we really need to resettle people? Can't we give money? I think Australia needs to listen carefully to what the UNHCR is telling the government. You know, where does Australian money need to be spent? Mm. And maybe that is right. Maybe it is spent in a much more efficient way if the money goes to looking after people in places such as Lebanon or Turkey. But I think what we also need to keep in mind is that Australia is overall an affluent country. It is more affluent than Turkey. It is more affluent than Lebanon, more affluent than Jordan.
And they're all carrying the bulk of this crisis.
That's right. So we need to think, what is our capacity? You know, what's our capacity to assist? And assistance could mean temporary protection. It could mean permanent resettlement. And it could mean financial assistance. One of your earlier, we were talking about quotas very briefly, and two callers said, well, we don't want to have quotas. I actually think quotas is a good thing. So if the international community could agree on some kind of system whereby they look at the capacity of countries to help and then say, well, you've got that GDP per capita, you've got such an unemployment rate, and therefore you can assist in this particular way, then that would go a long way towards alleviating the refugee crisis in the world. And I think that's what they are going to do in Europe now, because clearly the current situation is not sustainable.
And can I add to that?
Yes, Dai Li.
I mean, that is what I kind of alluded to in terms of the Vietnamese war, crisis, which is there was an international, collaboration over the issue. But going back to what Susan was just saying in terms of from one of the callers, is that we respond emotionally first of all, and to agree that to take the 12,000 and what happened to those also refugees currently in gulags or refugee camps that are spread across the world, that we haven't done anything at all, and that is a tension too. So from my perspective, I think we should look at increasing, and I think the government and the opposition and
increasing
the quota for the intake of refugees, and you know, we have to be more generous. I think look at it from the perspective of paying back to society. Obviously, it's going to be controversial. Obviously, the increase of 12,000 is on top of our current figures of 13,500 that we currently, initially the government didn't want to increase that number, but now that 12,000 is an addition to that 1,300. But I think overall, let's take a look. And once we actually make that decision to say, look, this is the quota, this is what we can do, and stick with that and say, you know, and realistically, as Klaus says, look at how it would impact on local services and say, look, it's not going to impact because this is in place, then I think explain that to the community, and I think there'll be less of that fear.
Yes. Klaus, you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, just a brief rejoinder to that. So when we look at our capacity and at what we are doing at the moment, I think we should also look at what we were able to do in the past. So at the time when your family came, Dai Li, Australia resettled far more people on a per capita basis than it is resettling now. And in the immediate post-war period, in 1949, Australia resettled 75,000 refugees from Europe. That's one refugee for every 100 Australians. If we did that now, we would have to resettle, more than 200,000 people. Obviously, that is a bit unrealistic. But I think we need to keep in mind that we can do far more than we are doing at the moment, because we were able to do that in the past.
And did the debates then, were they reminiscent of the debates now within the community?
Well, the debate then was reminiscent in the sense that there was a lot of emphasis on what refugees could do for Australia, so on their use value, as it were. And I think we should probably try to get away from that. So we should try to get away from the idea that we can accept refugees only if they are going to benefit the economy.
Well, it's a sort of utilitarian argument, isn't it? Akram Azimi, what do you make of that and this notion of a quota and upping the quota?
Well, I definitely think we can do it, and politically it can be done too, so long as we feel in Australia that this is a decision we're making and not a decision that's been made for us by others outside of our community, so to speak. So long as we feel it is our political will, our collective political will that's making this decision, we'll be absolutely fine with it. And to reflect on some of the things that have been said a little bit earlier, I think it's a bit of a false dichotomy sometimes to say, can we help those overseas or can we only help those here? They actually sometimes require very different modes of helping those. So for example, with respect to Indigenous Australians, there's a whole slew of things, a whole bunch of symbolic and cultural issues that we need to deal with, right? But whereas respect to the 10,000 people here in Western Australia who are homeless, effectively homeless, essentially sleeping without their own bed, there's a whole bunch of other things that we need to do. With respect to asylum seekers, they're not necessarily, and we think of them as a drain on the economy, that's not actually the case. There's a great study. This was a couple of years ago. I think it was from New South Wales, small little community where the refugees who had been resettled there in a little town that was quite aging quite rapidly, this injection of new demand, of new skills, of new labor in that community actually, I think, nearly $40 million was added over a small period of time because of these people's labour. That was actually more money for us as Australians to be able to spend on those who are least well off. It's not a choice between helping those here or helping those there.
I've got to take some calls.
Look, can I say that in terms of that's going to be hard to sell to the majority of the population? If you talk about, especially, say, in Western Sydney, where a lot of the refugees gets resettled, they will not accept the fact that they're not going to be a drain on our services, and they're not going to be sitting there receiving unemployment benefit, new house, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be very hard to actually get that message out that that's not happening.
Despite the fact that there's a large refugee population in that community.
Yes.
With lived experience of the issue. Let's take some calls because Lindy in Sydney has been waiting a while. You're a nurse who's worked in various refugee camps. Yes?
Yes, yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I worked as a nurse in Sudan with Ethiopian refugees, a couple of hundred thousand that were coming across the border from the war, and in Rwanda and Zaire. And the immediacy of needing to respond and bring people out, some people out of those situations, which does not happen, because I saw lots of babies, many, many hundreds, and I know thousands of babies died in the Zairean situation. And they don't have a voice, and they fade, and the aid agencies, we're all there, but we can't really do enough. They need to be in a safer place with better care. And I think it's fantastic that we're taking a very small number of refugees. 12,000 is nothing. But why can't the affluent world respond in a very humanitarian way? We can't have it all to ourselves.
Thank you, Lindy, very much for sharing that experience. And I guess it taps into the argument that's being made by our guests. Why can't the world collaborate and coordinate? And this is where a quota system might have a function. Patricia in Sydney, good morning to you. You were in Sydney. You were in Syria for 3 months, 2 weeks before the existing war.
Before everything blew up, and this before ISIS, and I was there, and I was in Aleppo, and I was in a wedding, and there were many weddings that weekend. You could hear music throughout the whole of the city, and I was standing up in the top of my hotel afterwards, after I was exhausted from dancing with the women. I was at the women's weddings, that party, and it was just so fantastic. And now I see on the television what Aleppo looks like. It's devastation. It's as bad as Gaza. It's just terrible. And those people have nowhere to go but to flee to the closest country, which is Turkey. And Turkey is already full. And then I also went to Palmyra, and I stood in that Baal temple, and it's no longer there, and that's terrible. My friends, the people I met, are no longer in Aleppo or Palmyra. I don't know where they are. They're all just scattered everywhere, running. And why can't we have more than 12,000? Why can't we have 24,000? What difference will it make? In 5 years, they'll all be working, paying tax. The kids will be at school, learning English. They'll make wonderful Australians. Let's have more.
Thank you so much for that, and I hope you do manage to make contact with those friends that you've lost connection with.
I do too. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Thank you. And it's that personal connection, isn't it, that does change our views. Liz in Melbourne.
Oh, hi.
You commenting on the imagery that's emerging.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen so many tragic images which have motivated people to take some action, but also I found equally powerful have been the amazing images of refugees being welcomed into Austria and Germany, and the dignity and the humanity that everyone shows, or everyone has been showing in those images, to me has been a motivation of a different kind, because it shows us what we can be and what humans can do for each other.
Yes, and I agree. Those have been amazing. Lots of footage of people walking into stations with crowds clapping them. It's the what next that occupies my mind. The what next. Yeah. Where will they sleep? How will they be integrated into communities with open arms? Yeah. That's what I'm curious about now. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
Go on. Do you want to make another point?
I was just going to say that I think that's very true, Natasha, but I also think that we could capture the momentum or the possibilities that people are feeling, that, you know, that we can rise over and above the pragmatism that sometimes limits what people think we're capable of to do for humans. And I think capturing that could be, you know, part of the changing public sentiment, or the changing perceptive view that it's all too hard and not in my backyard. We can't cope with this problem.
Yeah. NIMBYs. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
The NIMBY, the NIMBY attitude. Liz, thanks. Dan in South Melbourne, good morning.
Yeah, thank you. Look, bombing only strengthens the enemy's resolve, as it did in the Blitz during Britain and in Vietnam, where we lost. Now, our foreign minister, who was a woman, not like Angela Merkel, but still she's a woman, and she was asked, why can't we drop food instead of bombs? And she replied, well, dropping food is indiscriminate. Well, I say to her, drop non-halal food. That is food that the fundamentalist Muslims won't eat, non-halal. Christians should eat anything they like.
Okay.
Starving Muslims and Jews are permitted under the Torah and the Quran to eat to save their lives. So that's okay. A far more humane thing.
Drop food, not bombs. Let's hope.
Non-halal food.
All right. You've made your point. Thank you. And we've got Joyce. Oh, you'd like to pick up Di, I think.
Look, yeah. I'm talking in terms of Liz, what was she was saying before, in terms of building on this pragmatic, the momentum. And I think social media has a lot to play with it. And as you know, okay. It took a while, you know, for people to pick up on the image of that. But that image of that boy through social media really got people to respond to the situation. Just to that gentleman, look, I won't comment on that.
Yeah, no need. Joyce in Townsville, final call from you, just briefly.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to let everybody know that a few years ago, the mayor of Townsville proclaimed our city a refugee-friendly zone. But I have a question. Why are presidents like Assad allowed to persecute their own people to the extent that he is? Whose responsibility is that to stop that?
Oh, goodness. We need another hour for that one. Joyce, thank you for the call. And it's a good question, isn't it? We're going to wrap now, and I'd like a final comment from all of you about the what next, I guess. Very briefly, Akram Azimi.
Well, what next? I think we just need to practice our values, the values that we hold and ascribe to. And those are the values that ensured the Vietnamese refugees who came were integrated so well into Australia and are now fantastic Australians in every sense of the word. We can live with those values, and I promise things will work out.
Di Lee.
It takes a lot of hard work, Akram, and I think we need to make sure that those arriving here have got the support in terms of so they can actually be successfully integrated into society.
Because you contribute. Lived that challenge, didn't you?
I lived that challenge.
Arriving as a child.
That's right.
Yeah. And did people welcome you with open arms, or was it a slog?
It's my own interpretation that they did tried their best to welcome me. But I think I'd like to go to Dr. Simon Longstaff, a good friend of mine from the St. James Ethics Centre. You know, one of the guiding, he's written a piece about the guiding principles on how to treat refugees. There are 5 points. But I think one of the points must be that the distinctive nature of the cause of the great displacement now underway, and that's how we need to act on. What ought one to do?
We might put those 5 points on our Facebook page with your help, Di.
I will.
And finally to you, Klaus Neumann.
Well, I think the question, what next, is really, really crucial now for Europe, because there are all these hundreds of thousands of people who need to be accommodated somewhere. And I think the what we need to get away from is an emotional response, and we need to talk about the needs of these people, and we need to talk about their rights. And I think that's what distinguishes the conversation in some of those European countries from the conversation here. So we need to somehow change the discourse.
Thank you for such a rich and a complex discussion. I greatly appreciate it. Klaus Neumann, Professor of History at Swinburne University and author of, just getting the book,
Across the Seas,
Australia's Response to Refugees, to Akram Azimi in Perth, sociologist studying attitudes to refugees, and Di Lee, CEO and founder of Dawn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Terrific. And please keep the conversation going. Our listener feedback line, 028 333 1430, or join us on Facebook, or indeed on our website. You can comment there under today's program. Listen to the audio again. Subscribe to our podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter. We'd love to hear from you. There's so much to talk about on this one. Looking forward to joining you on Monday. Thank you today to Isabel Summerson for producing today's Talkback and the Life Matters team. Bye from me. Coming up to the news.